All right, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. My name is Janine Remtula. I'm a professor in the Department of Geography and the McGill School of Environment. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here tonight, or this afternoon. Before I forget, I'm going to ask you all, the camera people have asked us all to turn off our cell phones so that we don't get any random noise while our guest is speaking. So I'm going to start just by saying a few thank yous to those who've made this event possible. So the event is made possible by grants today by the Beatty Memorial Lectures Committee, by the Department of Geography, by the McGill School of Environment, and by the Faculty of Science. So thank you to all of those folks who have made this whole event, Eric's lecture tonight, as well as his visit on campus for a couple of days. A couple of people also, Sarah Wilson, who's a PhD student in the Department of Geography, whose idea this originally was and who's worked tirelessly to pull the whole event together, and Christina Zhu in the McGill School of Environment, who's also worked behind the scenes. So it's my very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Eric Higgs to McGill today. He's a professor of ecological restoration in the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria. He's trained as both a philosopher and an ecologist, and it's quite an incredible combination of depth and breadth in both of these fields that has led, in my experience anyway, to him asking really interesting and provocative questions. So he has a PhD at the university from the University of Waterloo in interdisciplinary philosophy and environmental studies. And it's a crazy combination that I think really leads to some very interesting thoughts. His accomplishments are many and varied. He's held academic appointments at Waterloo, at Oberlin, at the University of Alberta, at MIT, at the University of British Columbia, as well as the University of Western Australia. He was the director at the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria for a decade. And he's also the past chair of the Society for Ecological Restoration, as well as one of the people that founded the society, I believe. Know who was there from the beginning? All right, well, different versions of that depending on...
I read a book that mentions
his work is... there you go, it's in print, it's got to be true. His work spans conceptual issues in restoration. He does field work and field studies in historical ecology and landscape change. And he's also done a lot of policy work in restoration. He's written several books, Nature by Design, and then also most recently he's co-edited Novel Ecosystems with Richard Hobbs and James Harris, and of course has many journal articles and various other publications. So all of those things are the kinds of things that we usually celebrate in academia. I think what I appreciate most about Eric, as I've already said a couple of times, is his ability to ask really provocative questions. So I first met him when I was a master's student in the mid to late 1990s. I was working in Jasper National Park on a project that he was leading and had started there. And the key question that motivated that project was around ecological restoration in national parks. So what ought ecological restoration in national parks, what ought it to look like? And many of the parks people at that time in Jasper took great offense to this question. So here we were in kind of one of the icons of Canadian wilderness, and there's this guy, what was he doing, talking about restoration in one of these great wilderness areas. And so it turns out, a decade later, we know that those were really great questions to be asking, and a lot of people are doing that now. And in fact, a lot of Eric's work has led to the first primer of best practices on ecological restoration in parks and protected areas that's been adopted by Parks Canada. And in fact, he went on to co-chair a similar committee with the IUCN to develop a primer on ecological restoration for parks and protected areas at the global level. So he really asks interesting questions, and I look forward to what he has to say for us today. Please help me welcome Eric.
Thank you. Thank you, Janine. That was a generous and nice introduction. I'm sure you could have told other stories of tales in the mountains and field work, but you didn't, thankfully. It's an exceptional pleasure to be here and a real privilege. I must say, coming into this 19th century lecture hall makes me think that we should have a cadaver in front of us and doing some anatomical experiments. But it is really wonderful, actually, to be in a space as graceful as this one. Let me extend a few thanks, so certainly to Janine for her great collaboration over the years and for organizing this, to Sarah for your hard work in making this possible, and to the enjoyable conversations I've had already and look forward to before I leave tomorrow. Of course, I must extend appreciation and want to the Beatty program, the lecture program, which has made the event possible. And I also want to extend thanks to particular colleagues, all of my colleagues, I suppose, but particular ones, for helping shape these ideas, because as we know from our academic work, and this isn't a modest apology, but it's really a statement of fact that the work we do is informed so much by our interactions with peers and colleagues and students. It's so important. And so, in particular, Richard Hobbs, Jim Harris, Carol Hall, Brian Strzomski, and all of the students who I have the pleasure of working with now, and those who have been with me in the recent past. It's great to see Ellie Stevenson here, and Kristen Walsh, who's joining me this fall to do work at the University of Victoria. So it's really, it's lovely. Thank you. So we're such a restless species, huh? Right? And caught up with technological excess and all the hubris that that brings down on us. But what lies forward, I think, is hard to gauge in an age of exceptional challenge and ambition that we seem to have. So this ambition, I think, cuts in two directions. First, it suggests greater control and follows the track defined by American philosopher Albert Borgman. He argued for the device paradigm, a pattern by which we decompose things that matter into distinctive machinery and commodities. And we do this with devices, but we also do it with processes and practice. So ecosystem services, conservation offsets are examples of this. And I'm not going to dig much more into philosophy. You may draw a breath of relief. But I think what we see happening now is the machinery is concealed from plain view, so that which makes the commodities possible. And that was the signal insight that Borgman had. And that the commodity becomes more prominent and interconnected. And in this first sense, ambition means control. And control means increasing regulation of all systems, physical, chemical, biological, social. And I won't divert to a further discussion of hubris, but I think the implications are clear and that it's a major player always waiting just off stage. But the second form of ambition is responding to specific challenges, such as ecosystem degradation and destruction. The greater the challenge, the greater the armamentarium that we bring in response. And so we see a kind of profound reaching out to deal with that particular challenge around the degradation of ecosystems and declines in biodiversities. So we develop lists. So five big challenges is conventional, five big threats to biodiversity. I think, in fact, there are seven big threats to biodiversity. So let me shake this up a little bit. So we can speak first about ways in which we convert land from one use to another, often from so-called wild systems into human-dominated systems. Climate change, pollution in all forms, this being an Edward Bertinsky photograph of the oil sands, being at the tail end of two proposed pipelines in British Columbia, I need always to mention the oil sands. Overexploitation and invasive species, this being one of my favorite recent examples. Do you know the giant African land snail and it's invaded Florida? In a fairly big way. What's interesting is it needs a huge amount of calcium for its shell development, and so it's starting to feed on the stucco buildings in Florida. And also fascinating about this snail is that it creates slime tracks so vast that it actually has created an occupational hazard. People are slipping increasingly on snail tracks. There's some kind of interesting metaphor there, I think. So these are five conventional threats to biological diversity. But I want to add two more. So let's call this new natures. This image taken from a BBC Science article last Thursday about a very recent development in the synthetic in synthetic biology, looking at finally able to crack into the yeast genome and do significant things with reconstructing the DNA. So this is moving beyond genetic engineering. But synthetic biology, genetically modified organisms, biological engineering. Did you know that MIT has a department of biological engineering? Nanotechnology, DNA barcoding. These are just examples, but taken together, they constitute a new way of thinking about and seeing and experiencing nature. But finally, I want to add the seventh, which is to say the conversion of ecosystem processes into discrete services, which I see as a broad-scale pattern that is occupying a lot of what we do in conservation and restoration. It constitutes a really major shift. But broader than that, I think, is to acknowledge that we're shifting, and constantly shifting, I think, our cultural values about what counts as nature. And so this idea that there's not only threats to biodiversity in terms of those tangible physical things, if you will, but there's also shifts in cultural references and cultural values that affect how we think about the protection of biodiversity. As Mark Sagoff wrote recently about this trend in ecological economics in particular, and I mean not to, well, I guess I do mean slightly to assault ecological economics, but not in too profound a way. But he wrote, ecological economists ended up fully embracing the slogan of mainstream welfare economics, that protecting the environment is a matter of getting the prices right. A discipline that just a decade or two earlier had insisted the market was embedded in nature had learned how to embed nature in the market. So this is an example of a shift in how it is that we understand. Yes. Now, of course, we take these seven, you can disagree, I don't know whether they're six or 10, but you take these seven drivers and you put them all together with cumulative effects, and it creates a really complicated conundrum. So I've been addressing recently two broad questions, and they animate this lecture. The first is, how do we intervene responsibly in ecosystems we have never experienced before? So ecosystems that have really no historical analog, what do we do responsibly with those ecosystems, apart from leaving them alone? But that's not always the responsible action, I think. And then more particularly, how will ecological restoration be practiced in the future? Well, what does that look like? And not being a terribly good science fiction writer, I turn to Nebula award-winning author Kim Stanley Robinson for some advice on this. And I dedicate this particular slide to Esther, who's a student here, and we were speaking earlier about wild notions of nature, wild in that broader sense. But so Kim Stanley Robinson, I just want to, this seems like an odd departure in the lecture, but let me, bear with me. This novel is set 300 years in the future. And it has a kind of vertiginous quality about the writing. I mean, you just at points, you sort of feel like you're reeling from the ways in which he's imagined a future. We've expanded through the solar system. We've done lots of terraforming of different kinds. But one of the most interesting imaginative leaps that he makes in the book is that we've done a lot of asteroid mining. Now, I hadn't thought asteroid, I thought it was really, when I read this book a couple months ago, I thought, oh, that's just speculation. One of my students has just done a project on two American companies that have a genuine proposal to do asteroid mining. So I guess it's not that wacky. So we have innies and outies. Innies are asteroids that have been mined from the inside out and then engineered to create habitat for organisms that are brought from Earth and recombined into distinctive ecosystems. In fact, the novel suggests that there are 1,200 asteroids that have become these unique space terraria. And in the year 2312, the great reanimation occurs, in which organisms that have been stewarded in these asteroids spread across the solar system are simultaneously brought back to Earth to create this new flourishing in a planet that has 467 countries and, you know, the kind of strife and ecological degradation that we might imagine in our worst dreams. But that's all wild speculation and cool stuff. But what I found really interesting about this novel is that restoration still has a role to play. And in fact, restoration is mentioned, I think, in a really adroit way by Kim Stanley Robinson in the novel. He writes, I should just back up a little bit and say that, so sea level rise has left Florida as just a narrow ridge sticking out from continental North America. And he writes, using the narrow finger of a peninsula that was the state's only remaining land as their causeway, they were moving the segmented mountain interiors on trains and building the state as they had built rock jetties in older times. This rock, by the way, was coming from Canada. The Everglades were to be plumbed to function at the new higher elevation. Newly generated analogs of the many extinct species of birds and animals that had graced the peninsula before European immigration were to be introduced. They were going to recreate Florida. Enough carbon dioxide was to be buried under the northern Rockies to make the project, on balance, carbon negative. And then one of the protagonists in the book, a guy named Warham gestured at it. Landscape restoration is going on all over as people try to cope with the changes. And it's very labor-intensive and very tied to place. You can't do it from somewhere else. You can't take advantage of differential currencies. You can't really extract a profit from it. It's a public good, and it needs to be done. So I take some heart that maybe restoration will be around for a while. So it's not a practice that we can abandon. It's also a practice, I think, that speaks to that kind of place-based sensibility. And it's also, in using this book as a kind of prop, it allows us to take that imaginative leap and say, well, what is it going to be like in the future? And especially if we have all of these sort of cross-connecting drivers that I described a few minutes ago, where is that taking us? What is it going to look like? So, I don't know. It's... We can only take that kind of imaginary work so far, but I think these are fascinating questions to begin asking, because we're going to need to. If we're going to have, you know, technologies coming along as quickly as handheld DNA barcoding for biodiversity is, with expectations that we'll, within 5 years we'll have handheld sequencing technology available giving near real-time results, this is going to shift how we think about species, how we think about ecosystems, and where we go with it. Anyway, let me get off this particular kick and talk a little bit about restoration, which, as you, I think many of you may know from this definition, which is thought of as the gold standard from the Society for Ecological Restoration, is assisting the process of assisting the recovery of ecosystems that have been degraded, damaged, or destroyed. Now, this definition encodes two keystone concepts in restoration, ecological integrity, or some version of that, depending on how you describe it, and some notion of historical fidelity. So in acknowledging degradation as a cause for why we might act, we typically look to the source of the degradation and back beyond it in order to get a sense of what we do in the present and into the future. Now, I think those two keystone concepts, I argue actually that in the book Nature by Design, that there are two other keystone concepts that are also needing to be thought of, and one being sort of social engagement and participation, which are what I call focal practices, and some idea of design. But I won't dwell on that. And just as a cheap commercial announcement, just wanted you to know, that's the Restoration of Natural Systems Program at the University of Victoria. If any of you want to get your hands dirty with restoration training, it's a great program to do. But it also speaks to that sort of a recognition that restoration is becoming practiced in lots of different ways, and it's becoming mainstreamed in a way that it hasn't. I mean, look at the United Nations Environment Program, this document from 2010. And then Janine mentioned generously the Parks Canada document that came out in 2008 on principles and guidelines for ecological restoration. This was the first national level guidelines in the world on how to practice restoration. And it embedded three key concepts. For restoration to work, it needed to be effective, so it needed to get the job done, needed to be efficient in the sense of delivering with reasonable material and labor. And then the controversial one that isn't controversial really any longer is that it needs to be engaging. So it needs to actually connect people with places. This one, which is the IUCN document Jeanine also mentioned, is a very significant document. It's a game changer in the sense that it, for the first time, sees restoration being practiced under conditions of change, so especially climate change. And so this is one to look at. And if this wasn't an indication that restoration has hit the big screen, so to speak, it's become popular, this sign in Calgary, I think, sums it up even better. So, yeah. Now, I've been reflecting on the dynamics of change for some time, and I have been doing this through a project that I call the Mountain Legacy Project, and I owe huge debt to Jeanine for spurring this project on through her graduate work at the University of Alberta. Somehow things didn't work out so well for Jeanine, and she's had to stop climbing mountains, but maybe we'll get her back at it again. This is a photograph a couple years ago from the rim of the Kaskawalsh Glacier in Kluane National Park. And that's what it looked like in 1900 when J.J. MacArthur, a Dominion land surveyor, traversed this area as part of a formative study looking at mapping the boundary between Alaska and the Yukon. And if you pay attention to the trim line here on the glacier, the Kaskawalsh has a termination somewhere in here. Take my word for it. It extends 80 kilometers up to its origin. This is what it looks like today, or at least in 2012 when we took that photograph. So for some reason, my slow fade animation has stopped working. I'm not sure why that is. So, I'll flip through that again, but just get a sense of the magnitude of that glacier wasting. All right. I'm going to just do a brief walk through what this project is about for two reasons. One is I want to indicate that this kind of deep historical practice has led to some interesting reflections on the nature of change that I want to share. But it's also, I want to let you know that this collection of historical images is becoming kind of open source now and looking to cultivate more research with it. So be happy to talk to people about it. So surveyors traversed the mountains of Canada from 1888 to 1958, creating topographic maps for geological and land mapping purposes. They created topographic maps using a made-in-Canada technology, phototopographic surveying, and produced exquisite maps going to incredible length to do it. They climbed tens of thousands of promontories and mountaintops to do this, and apparently it killed some of them. I don't know. Do you think that's a corpse in the corner? It's hard to tell. Could just be somebody sleeping. I don't know. But we've gone back. Ellie Stevenson will recognize Stuart Higgs in this photograph. I forgot that we were going to connect. I should have put a photograph of you in here. Sorry. And we get to some pretty interesting locations in remote regions that are pretty inaccessible. And how could I not put in the photograph? For those of you, how many of you have Dr. Rimtula as an instructor, as a professor, right? That's what she looked like when she was climbing mountains. Yeah, it's hard to tell, but yes, Jeanine was, we actually had to tie her in. This was before WorkSafe, occupational safe. So we were really worried about her blowing off the edge of Roche Ronde. And so we actually tied her to the rock so she wouldn't go away. But notice the antique camera equipment, large format film cameras. And that's what I looked like without a beard. And just this one is a picture I've always really enjoyed of Janine doing a really dangerous thing. This is the picture that she promised, or she made me promise I would never show her parents. So the work we do is to go back and repeat these images, and you can see, in this case, Ryan Hilpert's lining up a shot of Mount Assiniboine. And it leads us to these really fascinating comparisons that show very dramatic change that's being driven by a lot of different forces. This in the Wilmore Wilderness, you can see quick impression, because we can't spend too much more time on it, but just a quick impression of the changing patterns. Or in one of the iconic parts of Canada's national parks, this is Banff as it looked in 1888, 3 years after the founding of the town of Banff and the creation of Rocky Mountain National Park. That's what it looked like. You can see the embryonic town of Banff here and the embryonic golf course here. So, yeah. It's so these images tell lots of different stories. They tell stories of the kind of really well-integrated land use that we saw from Métis farmsteaders who occupied the Upper Athabasca Valley and were forcibly evicted from their lands when the park was Jasper National Park was created. And we also are telling stories of climate change. This is Will Rausch's work, who looked at the upper movement of the tree-lined ecotone in Kootenay National Park and showed a change in forest composition that's really striking. So this is how he lined it up. Roughly, that's where he drew the tree, the upper reach of the tree-lined ecotone in 1906, and that's where it appears. And you can see from the, I'm told not to use my pointer, it's such a natural instinct. But you can see here that we've seen not only a change in the pattern of the trees on the hill slope, but we also see trees now right at the top of the ridge. So one of the most dramatic tree line increases in a century that's been documented. But we're also more recently working with custom-developed software to do analytics on these images, which has proven to be really elusive and much more challenging than we had expected. But we are getting there, and we have a tool that will now do semi-automated classification of these images. So we have this incredible set of maps and images. We have the largest systematic mountain photography collection in the world. It's based in Ottawa, Library and Archives Canada, the BC Archives, and we have repeated more than 5,000 images. So it's a large data source, and as I mentioned before, I wanted to encourage people, in case you're interested, to follow this up, because it's quite an amazing collection for studying change. But this idea of climbing these mountains over the last 15 years and being in the field and experiencing these and looking at the images and interpreting them and analyzing them has led me to think a lot about the dynamics of change. And this has really influenced my thinking about restoration. And it got me recently to think about, well, what's actually driving change in the practice of restoration? So I began enumerating some of that. And over the last decade, we see some really interesting patterns, I think. We see greater engagement, so a greater recognition that restoration practice depends on people and engagement in communities. We see a much greater recognition of cultural variety. There was a real American, North American-centered view, a wilderness view of ecological restoration that was laid on top of the world initially. And that's transformed into a much more variegated notion of how restoration is practiced in different places. There's, of course, a real upsurge in understanding of invasive species. And that's been a big part of the story in the last decade. A real interest in real rewilding and sort of creative practices. Lots of talk and some action around assisted migration. And then ecological novelty, in which we start to see the development of non-analog ecosystems. So these six, there's others, have been shaping a new kind of ecological restoration. And for traditional practitioners or even people who are starting out, it can seem a lot like Sisyphus trying to push the ball uphill, the big rock. And that's what you feel like occasionally as a restoration ecologist. In response to all these different changes, several of us got together in 2011 and began to map out what these non-analog ecosystems would look like based on some work that had been developed in, starting around 2005, 2006, and resulted in a book called Novel Ecosystems that came out last year about this time. As I'll mention later, we did this in large measure to provide greater flexibility for thinking about restoration into the future. But let me just quickly treat what novel ecosystems are in terms of how we define them. We say that there has to be a difference in composition, structure, and or function. So something has to be significantly different. That there's thresholds in these attributes that are currently irreversible. So they reach some kind of threshold that you can't go back easily. And also that these systems are persistent, or that there's qualities of self-organization that give rise to distinctive new formations. So what are the drivers of novel ecosystems? Well, I think they're largely the drivers I spoke about earlier in terms of biodiversity, if we include the social dimensions as well. And based on some of the inspired work that Naveen Ramakutty and Earl Ellis and others have done in mapping remapping the world to show anthropogenic biomes, we can also extract ideas that show maybe the extent of ecological novelty on the planet. Work that I think is beginning to show, although there's a long way to go with this, beginning to show that novel ecosystems are not just sort of unusual little patches here and there, but in fact show very significant extent. Conceptually, though, novel ecosystems are only the kind of the extreme outlier case. And I think a lot of the action actually happens more in the middle in what we call hybrid ecosystems. So if you take, if you cross composition with function and you start at the origin point where you're close to historically continuous ecosystems, on the other side, you have novel systems. In the middle, necessarily must be something, so we called it hybrid. But the hybrid zone is really intriguing because it actually opens up a zone of greatest contestation. I suspect, although we don't have a lot of evidence yet, that we'll actually figure out, we know how to deal with historically continuous systems through restoration, and we're starting to respond to novel ecosystems. It's that zone, it's probably pretty big in the middle, that will be very complicated. So a few examples. So work done by Mandy Truman and Mark Gardner with the Charles Darwin Research Foundation in the Galapagos Islands. It showed that on Santa Cruz Island, Myconia shrublands, which were documented as the historically long-term ecosystem occupying the uplands of Santa Cruz Island, had been replaced by the red quinine tree and plantation forests, in effect, that had pushed out a lot of the Myconia communities. And one outcome of this invasion is certainly an increased structure, a place for epiphytes. So you get a kind of a pretty big transition state in how these ecosystems function. It's not only the invasive plant species, there's also the black rat, which figures into a complicated story about how this regime shift unfolded. But what was interesting is that, you know, it's Galapagos Islands, the cradle of evolutionary theory of natural selection, more specifically, and it is also a place where enormous conservation effort takes place. And the Charles Darwin Research Foundation was not especially happy with Mark Gardner in particular, who said, you know, I don't think we can restore these systems. The best that we can do is probably a zonation in which we can look at different kinds of treatment and try to focus on species of conservation importance and try to wrestle with managing these systems in a way that produces those kind of conservation outcomes. But if you want the island to look like what it did when Darwin landed, you're probably not going to make it happen. Not for love nor money. So that's a case of a kind of a more celebrated one that's starting to, and there's some interesting stories coming out in the literature, including one that I'm going to talk about a bit tomorrow that Mandy Truman has followed up on. But the stories are also extremely subtle. This one that adapted from Graham Stone's paleoecological work, piecing together what has to be almost a forensic ecology project. So the turkey oak was native to the British Isles prior to the last glaciation, so roughly 130 to 115,000 years before present. So there's evidence of turkey oak from back then. It didn't disperse naturally after that, so it hasn't dispersed naturally in the Holocene. But it was reintroduced to the United Kingdom 300 years ago because it was a favorable horticultural species that people were bringing in during their trips to the Mediterranean region where the turkey oak had flourished. So you could think of this as kind of an early form of assisted migration. But the story has been complicated by the fact that there were lots of conservation concerns in the 20th century as people began to see the turkey oak spread and worried that it might become an invasive species. It doesn't appear that that's happened, but it brings up really complicated questions about nativity in these systems. But furthermore, the works demonstrated that the species acts as a reservoir for two songbird species, both of which have had, which are laying their eggs earlier in the season in response to climate cues. And these birds are also of conservation concern, and so their populations declined for a good part of the 20th century. But the oak also acts as a host for gall wasps, many of which are also non-native and migrating northwards. And they provide food source for the songbird population before the emergence of their normal food sources. So what's happening, there was this asynchronous timing. The birds went into steep decline because the native gall wasps, and which would be a conventional food source, was badly timed with the earlier and earlier emergence of the songbirds. So this is a kind of multi-trophic interaction that is really hard to tease apart, because we look at, you know, the non-native gall wasps are interacting with the native gall wasps. There's interactions with species of conservation concern, and you've got these interactions, which some people regard as positive and others regard as negative. And this is a very subtle form of complex interaction that we're starting to see, and it has all sorts of, it sets up conundrums for us around what we do in terms of intervention. And speaking of conservation conundrums, there's the endangered Richard Hobbs. No, but there is Richard Hobbs, this is in his somewhat normal habitat. On Rottnest Island off Perth in Western Australia, staring down a deadly quokka. That's why he's wearing the bicycle helmet. Actually, the quokka is one of the sweetest marsupials you could ever imagine. It is critically imperiled. It's on the IUCN Red List and is extant now only on Rottnest Island. It's heavily protected, and then on a fenced reserve on the continental Australia. But the quokka has done really well on Rottnest Island. It's been fed by people. It doesn't have a lot of predators, almost none. And so it's actually become hyperabundant. And so when you look at exclosure experiments that have been done on the island, you can see really dramatic differences between the areas grazed by the quokkas and what the island vegetation looks like. This has opened up processes for the arrival and prosperity of invasive plant species as well. So the system is being transformed as a result of a conservation intervention. But nobody's recommending whacking quokkas in order to deal with the ecosystem changes that have taken place. Conservation conundrums, very significant. And then changing how we think about, this is really a story about a hybrid ecosystem. This is the pathway that I take to work every day in Victoria. It's the Cedar Hill Park. And if you, for I don't know how many times, dozens, hundreds maybe, of times I'd walk through this pathway, and I never really thought too much about the ecosystem. A bit embarrassed about that, but I hadn't thought too much about it. I was usually focused on what I was going to be doing at work or what I was going to be doing at home. And I always thought of it as a Gary Oak-dominated ecosystem, which it is, because that's a Gary Oak. It's a species of conservation concern. The whole Gary Oak ecosystem is a system of concern in Canada. One day I stopped and I stumbled over English hawthorn, which I hadn't seen there before. And then I looked around and I saw, oh, there's English ivy and there's Daphne loreola and there's Scotch broom and did I mention English holly? You know, so the understory, except for snowberry, which is a bit of an aggressive native plant, all of the understory comprised invasive species, exotic ones. Most. And I realized that this is an ecosystem that has reached a kind of hybrid form. And the restoration community is very interested in taking these ecosystems and restoring them back to their pre-degraded state, which would mean trying to do something with the understory. The challenge, though, is that the propagule rain in this area from bird dispersal of seeds and wind dispersal and human and dog dispersal of seeds is so great that to actually maintain this system once the alien invasive species have been removed would require horticultural intensity to maintain this system. And so you've got to make a commitment to restoration is to make a commitment in this particular case to something I'm not quite clear we'll be able to honor. So novel ecosystems occur when a threshold is crossed that in practice is irreversible and that new management goals are needed for the resulting novel ecosystem. And there's a kind of irony that pops up here, is that maintaining historical continuity will require increasingly intense interventions. So the more we look to to try to push these systems back into classical restoration, the more they're going to push against us, and we're going to have to do more work. Now, lest you think that I'm a cheerleader for novel ecosystems, the book Novel Ecosystems actually spent a lot of time addressing worrisome issues about novel ecosystems, and in fact enumerated all sorts of wicked questions that we can come up with. You know, what criteria do we use to judge ecosystem desirability? Can we engage new natures without ambition and hubris taking over? Let me know what you think of that question and what your answer is. But how do we reconcile various and conflicting economic, cultural, and aesthetic values? Do we manage for adaptation or avoidance of the problem in the first place? And do we have the moral capacity to responsibly engineer ecological processes to create desirable new ecosystems? So in other words, if we set on a course where we start to say, all right, we're going to have to deal with all this rapid change coming upon us, can we do it? Can we do it well? It's not clear to me we can. Now, these kinds of questions have been picked up in the last couple of years by a series of fascinating books, including J.B. McKinnon's Once and Future World, George Monbiot's Feral, and one of my favorites, Emma Maris's Rambunctious Garden. So there's a lot of fascination with these kinds of questions and coming to terms with these. We are not terribly close, I think, to practical answers in a general way, although there's lots of different ways in which we're trying to sort this out. So the ideas of novel ecosystems really are an attempt to bolster restoration practice, not to displace it. So it's trying to say that we have a wider range of goals for systems undergoing rapid change, and that this can be really helpful. I've spoken to a lot of restoration practitioners who really feel stuck. They don't know what to do. So they feel, I'm going down to Portland, Oregon, in a couple of weeks to talk to the city of Portland's Parks Department, because they're just stuck, and they really want to see, is there a broader way in which they can take their goal setting? And I think novel ecosystems offer options for what lies beyond restoration in the strict sense, or classical restoration. And in a recent paper that that Janine and I have been working on, that's coming out soon, we've suggested that maybe there's classical restoration here, 1.0, in which history is seen as a template and there's singular trajectories and an emphasis on composition, but that's shifting to a newer and hopefully more widespread, bigger practice, because I think it's a good thing to do, where history is seen more as a guide. That there's lots of different potential trajectories, that processes are more the emphasis rather than composition, and that there's a more pragmatic focus on dealing with livelihood needs, because that's one thing that we've learned and we should have learned a long time ago, is you look, especially in the global south, where restoration is really about livelihood, and it's about being able to provide services that make life possible. But one of the big players here, and the reason that tackled this particular article on the role of history in ecological restoration, is really to think more deeply about what will happen to the idea of historical knowledge in the future as we change our practices significantly. Because if it is one of the keystone concepts in restoration, and we seem to have all this rapid change, and we're starting to maybe take away the tethers that hold us to historical conditions, what's going on there? Well, we came up with a kind of counterintuitive observation, because we took historical knowledge, and thanks to our historian collaborators, they said, well, maybe history is a genus and we need to look at the species within. So we did that. And we actually, well, originally, what did we have, 24 different types of historical knowledge? And the reviewers forced us down to 9. But these are 9 types of historical knowledge that have been grouped into 3 categories. I'm not going to dwell on this too much. I'm happy to share this manuscript if you're interested. But what we found is we did a kind of, call it expert assessment, if you will, based on our experience about what was happening to those different types of knowledge. And it turns out, counterintuitively, that historical knowledge may in fact be more significant in the future, more needed than less needed. And so that's got me thinking a lot about different kinds of strategies for where we're going to go with responsible intervention in the future. It gave me a bit of hope as well to think that we can actually tether ourselves still to historical knowledge, that we can pause long enough to do that kind of work and serve as an orienting framework. So with that in mind, I'm taking the risk. I don't think one is supposed to do this too much, but I want to talk about strategies for change. And this is very tentative, so be gentle with me. And a thing seems, things seem to be happening in sevens, so there's 7 strategies. And the first one is about historical continuity. And it's about recognizing that we are going to continue to use and depend upon historical knowledge in myriad forms in moving forward. And that this is something that we need to reinforce and I think give greater attention to. Skeptical for some number of years about the notion of resilience, I think that some of the emerging research on resilience practices in science is exhilarating and holds great promise in getting us to think about, well, if we can't actually do what we've done with classical restoration and we have to intervene in systems that are increasingly novel, can we do so with a commitment to resilience in all of the ways that it does? I think we need to deploy innovative decision-making techniques. And the range of these techniques is broad. This slide emphasizes work coming out of Australia and primarily the work of Hugh Possingham and Tara Martin. Really innovative work, but they will tell you that they know the value of all ecosystems in Australia and they can compute that numerically and come up with economic rationales. And I think that's not a bad way to go in some respects. I think it's important information. But I think we also have much more complicated decisions too that we need to find decision approaches that help us out. So in this case, that goes back to that sort of the diagram I showed before about novel ecosystems, where at each point where the ecosystem sits in the state space, we have choices, not just bifurcated choices like this simple diagram shows. But in fact, in order to push an ecosystem back, you know, toward historical continuity, it's going to take a lot of effort. And one has different choices about how you do that. And that is going to depend on deliberation. It's going to depend on a lot of discussion. In fact, I was joking with Janine the other night that, in fact, we may be looking at a new kind of ecology called negotiation ecology in the future. Or is it Rosenzweig's idea of reconciliation ecology? But something like that. Is I think we need to converse more about what it is that we think about these ecosystems and how we can move forward and arbitrate, mediate, negotiate futures that speak to responsible intervention. And it isn't going to be perfect, and it isn't going to be easy, and there's no quick fix. So it's going to take a lot of deliberation. I floated the idea of this idea of wild design before. I think one of the ways that we can embed a greater responsibility is to acknowledge that restoration and intervention in hybrid and novel ecosystems requires an explicit design practice. And of course, design has kind of technological connotations in some ways. But I want to pull that back by recognizing that when we're designing with ecosystems, we're always designing with wildness in mind, that we know these ecosystems are going to do things that aren't predictable and aren't within our ability to control. That's what we love about them. But so working through ideas of wild design, in this case, an image from work that graduate student Rick Cubian did in Kootenai National Park, looking at how you can address specifically multiple different objectives in a restoration project. I've been swayed. I met with Greg Michelson earlier today and reminded me of the really fascinating work that he's been doing and philosophers have been doing, looking at questions of ethical responses to rapidly changing systems. I've been really influenced by Alan Thompson's work in this, in particular, this book on ethical adaptation to climate change. But really getting to think about moral responsibility in a way that embeds a recognition of what it is as professionals, as practitioners, we espouse when we do the work we do. So you say, well, what is a good restoration practitioner? If you set out a series of rules, that results in maybe effective practice, but it doesn't result in a resilient or adaptable practice. And so what Alan argues is we need to think about virtues of the future. So what is it that restoration ecologists are going to need to know? So he and Bill Throop and others have come up with, you know, virtues that sort of apply to conventional virtue ethics, things like fidelity, humility, sensitivity, self-restraint. But then we can add new virtues, in this case, say, historicity, the quality of being historical, the quality of minding our historical moments and memories. So that's what, so I think there's some intriguing new work that's being done to help situate that. And finally, you've been waiting for it. It feels like a Letterman list or something. Sorry. Yeah, here it is. I have seen so many examples of that place attachment that comes from learning moments done through restoration, and that isn't going to change. The kind of intervention practices that are done with humility and self-restraint result in place attachment that's so profound. This photograph is from a group of students in 2006 that I took down to Beacon Hill Park, where a group of community volunteers was doing work on restoring coastal Douglas fir ecosystem, the last really significant remnant in the city of Victoria. And in the course of 3 hours of pulling weeds and planting, and in this case, the photograph shows them planting blue camas bulbs, The participants were profoundly changed, and by profoundly changed, I meant that I had them write reflection assignments that told me about what their experience was. And then for several years afterwards, and still occasionally, the students will come to me and say, I still go back to Beacon Hill Park. I check on how things are going. And so there's that commitment, even though they don't live there. It's not their backyard exactly. But they've had an interconnection that's really important, and that isn't going to change. So that's what gives me a fair bit of hope. And that kind of place attachment extends to the sort of relationships that we hope our children will have as they grow up. Thank you very much. Oh, right, right. I can't see you very well. Those are really bright lights. Yes?
How far back does your history go? I'm a
paleontologist. Oh, right. Yeah, you guys always come in over top of us, all right? Yeah. All right, that's shallow history. Go deep time. We go back. Oh, you mean the work that we're doing in the mountains? Or?
Can you use the word history?
Oh, yeah, right. I know. I know. I think typically it means after, if you want to be precise. But I think it's also about the kinds of evidence that we have that's convincing. And I think the work of paleoecology has come on so strong in the last 20 years and has given us much more complex portraits that go back deeper in time. Yeah.
So your history, so when you think about this, you put up these slides, are you thinking more like historical records, so, or the
well, that's all I can pay.
Before European settlement in North America?
It's various, to be honest. I mean, it goes back. It's partly advantageous data. I mean, it's hard to get comprehensive data in a lot of places one works. And sometimes, you know, if you're working in, you know, in midtown Manhattan and trying to recover an abandoned lot, it's really hard to get a lot of, you know, reliable evidence about what was really there, although sometimes you can't. Or if you're working in a place like Jasper National Park or the Upper Athabasca Valley where there has been some decent paleoecological work and you can stretch back a sense of what the climate record and the pollen analyses show about the sorts of ecosystems that have been there over time. And then that serves to inform, you know, an approach to restoration that's been defined around, you know, range of variability. You know, if we can define what the boundaries are of how a system has changed, then as long as we operate within that envelope, we're okay. But now I think we're starting to push that even out, right? And you would know better than I do about just how much out of, you know, away from those norms we're getting in some of our systems. Yeah.
Maybe a follow-up question. I mean, I've heard a lot of issues that some of your talk answers the first question, which is that as a historian, looking at this stuff, it seems that ecologies are composed by different times. There's
right.
The rhythms of time, paleoecology contributes to an understanding of slower rhythms and change.
Yes, yes.
Processes and thinking about how they articulate to us, that might be part of thinking about this. But my question is kind of along those lines, which is that if you could talk a little bit more about the shift in how you guys are looking at history from history as template to history as guide. I mean, what does that mean for you, if you could give some examples?
Sure. Well, I'll focus maybe on an example locally in Victoria where we're working and trying to piece together just trying to think of a good example to use that will illustrate this. I was on a panel the other night with Richard Hebda, who's a paleoecologist at the Royal BC Museum, and my colleague Brian Strzomski, looking at restoration locally and some of the challenges with changing climate, and came up, a lot of historical questions came up in that particular panel. And we focused on some of the ecosystems in southern Vancouver Island and trying to address what's happening in terms of directional change and how people respond to that. And one of the intriguing insights that came out, not so novel, but is that scale dependence really matters. So if you're working in your backyard trying to deal with invasive species, and you happen to have a backyard that has a northern aspect and is quite cool, it may actually harbor ecological relationships that we've been familiar with for a longer period of time than another patch that has a different set of microconditions. So in some ways, the historical, so how you actually work with historical data depends to an extent on where your patch is located in space. It depends. So it's giving, I think, by reinforcing different types of historical knowledge, it gives us flexibility about what to emphasize given what the particular struggles are that we're facing in our context. So if you've got that example of Cedar Hill Park, where we're wrestling with this resistant understory vegetation, and you think, well, let's try to get a sense of what we can do to restore this, but if we can't restore it, how do we reassemble that ecosystem in a way that continues to deliver conservation value, if you will, and has a gesture to some of the historically continuous process that exists on that site? So it's opening up some greater space for discussing what we do rather than a kind of quick reaction to getting it back to the way it was pre-disturbance when it just won't work. Yeah, please.
I was wondering if just sort of a wide open question, sort of looking more to the future, but there's this term Anthropocene that's emerging.
Right.
And, I mean, it sort of has a, you know, kind of a profound, just within the word, profound statement about the human-Earth relationship and these questions of history and trajectory. So I was wondering how that idea comes into your work, if you've thought about that.
I mean, the idea of the Anthropocene has been a powerful concept for getting us to think differently about our participation in the transformation of ecosystems around the world, right? So it's really a profound, so when you use the word Anthropocene and you unpack it a bit, people get the idea very quickly that, wow, we've had this profound change, and the kind of, you know, the anthromes models that, you know, we've seen from the work that Naveen has done really illustrate that beautifully. It has a bit of a downside, though, too, which is that it almost feeds a certain fire around our interest in further transformation. It's like, oh my gosh, we live in the Anthropocene, we've transformed so much, we're an ambitious species, let's keep going. Right? And, you know, we sit perhaps, and I think I'm accurate in assessing likely this audience as people who have concerns about this idea of human ambition in relation to conservation and restoration. But there are lots of people out there who don't share those particular concerns. One would argue players likely to have more general authority in terms of how policy gets made. Yes. Yes.
So why would we want to restore novel ecosystems? And is using the word restore, is it the right?
No, it's not the right word. And this is something, you know, I was working on, you know, ideas of novel ecosystems for a while, and it hadn't actually occurred to me that one of the things you might want to do is to identify a novel ecosystem that was degraded and actually try to recover, function in that novel ecosystem, so that the restoration took on an entirely different connotation from restoration we think of in terms of historical continuity. So we need, certainly, I don't know if that addresses, but we need new terminology, I think, in some ways around this. And intervention ecology is one term that's been floated. I don't like that term much. It seems to me intervention is a pretty neutral to nasty word. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it depends what we want, like you said, what we want to maintain in the ecosystem.
Right.
Your response is to focus on the function. So if we we're talking about species composition,
yeah.
certain type of species, perhaps maintaining functions. They may be native species, they may be exotic species, introduced species, and they may well be able to maintain these functions. So it depends very much on the kind of goals that we want to achieve.
I think that's right. Exactly right. But figuring out, you know, those goals are going to, you know, what we think of as popular goals will shift depending on our sort of broader cultural understanding of these systems, you know, what's popular in a sense and what we, you know, what's acceptable. And I don't know what is underneath that to give something more durable. I sort of think sometimes we need to apply, I use this rather loosely, but the Alder-Leopold test, which is that, you know, Leopold's Sand County Almanac and the work that he did is cited as a conservation classic, and he's lionized for that work. And we still read Sand County Almanac and derive, you know, value from that, what, 70 years later. And so, in a sense, we can say, well, Leopold didn't get it all right, but he got enough right that we can look back in time and see that. And so I sort of think that our decisions need to kind of pass the Leopold test, in a sense, is that, you know, three or four generations down, people will look back and say, well, they didn't get it all right, but they got a lot right. And I'm not quite sure how we're going to do that and whether we're actually on track for that right now. I suspect we're not. Yes?
You started off your talk by referring to 7, 5, 6, whatever threats to biodiversity.
Some number greater than 4.
Right.
Yeah.
I was struck by two things there that had implications for everything else you talked about.
The okay.
One is, one's more important than the other. One of them is that you could have easily lumped invasive species with synthetic cells and GMOs all together as novel biological entities.
Okay.
The reason you would do that is because it emphasized that where they're placed, there would be no little or no evolutionary experience with them. So they would be out of an evolutionary context.
Right.
Evolutionary mismatch.
Right. That's a, yeah.
I haven't heard the word evolution mentioned in this talk, by the way, or restoration. And that's the first point. I'll get to that in a second. The second thing is
really?
you stopped with cumulative effects.
Okay.
I would have added synergistic effects as well.
Okay.
What I'm seeing now is
okay.
interaction between multiple stressors like climate change and
yes.
species and others that are producing things that would be very difficult to predict.
Yeah.
And the novel biological entities, by their name, it's very difficult to predict what they'll do outside of their evolutionary context. So we're left with situations where we have very great difficulty understanding what's going to happen. Even it's difficult enough even to do a post-mortem, never mind predict what will happen. Just figuring out what happened after the mess has occurred. So that's one reason why I'm highly skeptical about interventionist tinkering, such as assisted colonization and things like that.
Yep.
Because you mentioned hubris. When I see Paul Goldberg put out a science paper, and he has in his risk assessment, which decides if you're going to intervene, a little flow chart. And flow charts make us feel better because it makes it seem like everything's organized and it'll direct us to a decision. And I see some of those boxes that say, if the net benefit exceeds the detriment perceived. And I'm saying that, having spent 20 years trying to predict these things, we are nowhere near being able to answer the question, that box, in such a way that we would proceed safely with widespread interventions such as assisted colonization. So that's the world we're building. We're building a world where there's so much complexity we've added on to it that I'm not sure we can catch up with it and act like a doctor and remedy what we've done
yeah.
in an interventionist way.
Those are excellent points. I appreciate that. I'm sorry I didn't mention the evolutionary term. I like the way that you have lumped together, though, invasive species with synthetic biology and that sort of development, because I think that's exactly right, and it probably is best seen in evolutionary perspective. But what's the option? What's the alternative?
That's what I get asked. But you see, if ecologists are treated as urban doctors, as I like to see this, they're giving you a prognosis. They may offer you, here's what you could do to stave it off, right? But the problem with these, with problem with assisted colonization, for example, and some other similar interventionist ideas, is that they are techno fixes, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with techno fixes is that they don't address the root cause. They tell you, we got to do something, because conservation biology is a crisis discipline. We have to make a decision. We have to do something.
Right.
And I agree that you have to do something. What I'm saying is, let's not have the false confidence that we're addressing the issue by doing something new. And I believe that assisted colonization offers us a shiny silver bullet to conservation biologists who have been ravaged by a litany of doom and gloom stories. The problem is, it looks to me like another techno fix like the geoengineering to combat climate change. That's how I look at it. And just if that's the case, it means that widespread intervention, at times interventions will work, and it's a good idea to try them. Widespread intervention is not a solution to dealing with this problem, to dealing with the problems of the anthropocene.
Yeah. Well, I sort of promised not to engage much more philosophical thinking, but it does remind me of the maxim that Albert Borgman developed a number of years ago, where he said we exist in a society that lurches between sullenness and hyperactivity, and that when we are in our sullen phases, we sort of throw our hands up and say we don't know what to do. And of course, as ambitious creatures, we seem to want to move towards that hyperactive response. Yeah, let's bring on the assisted migration. Let's do this. Let's do that. We'll try a whole bunch of different things and see how they turn out. And he argues that it is neither the hyperactive nor the sullen response that we need, but a more mindful approach to these issues that is, you know, defined by modest ambitions and practices that are well negotiated and well discussed. And I would say that my experience in restoration, to a certain extent in conservation ecology, is that we tend to black box those thorny value questions and not actually pull them out into the open. And we tend to, I'll give you an example recently, in Uplands Park in Victoria, where an exquisite detailed restoration plan was tossed out the window by the local residents. And it was because the plan called for the removal of English hawthorn trees, which the restoration ecologists, I think, rightly identified as an alien invasive species that had a threat to the overstory Gary Oak communities. But what they didn't recognize was the number of neighbors who actually valued the English hawthorn for their colorful berries in the fall. And as dog walkers, they had a very powerful lobby. And the plan went to pieces. And it was largely because I think the sort of restoration fundamentalism that operated there, where it wasn't possible to see that there were differently refracted values about what was appropriate to do in that place, and there wasn't any kind of appropriate way forward. I mean, I think that it's now the plan's fallen apart and there isn't any sort of reasonable outcome. Anyway, I ramble, but thank you for that. I can't see much. I'm blinded. Yeah, please.
I think that's a really good point to make there, that these things are really way too complex to try to intervene and fix in ourselves, except that I do also think that you've enhanced the complexity by treating it all as one giant problem. There may be situations where it is a little bit more clear if we should intervene. For example, if we're going to cut a forest down and then plant it, should we replant it at the same provenance from there, or should it be from further south?
Right. I mean, a story about that. I've been working with the Galliano Conservancy Association on Galliano Island, one of the Gulf Islands between Vancouver and Victoria. And they're dealing with restoration of a plantation forest that was planted by Macmillan Bloedel following logging. And the cultivars of Douglas fir that brought in were actually raised, of course, in tree propagation facilities in the central interior and brought in and didn't match the specific genetic stock. But the horse is out of that barn, or the tree is out in the landscape, in that, you know, what are you going to do? Take all those out and replant them? No. So you deal with a kind of pragmatics around how that works. There was another point I was going to mention, but... I can't remember the other point.
Excellent. All right, maybe that's a good place to stop. We have a reception to follow with wine and cheese, so I'll invite all of you to stick around and come and ask Eric more questions, ask one another questions, and invite you to help me thank Eric for a great talk.
Thank you.